to hear us, to know we are here for them.
Among the banners that the hundreds of protesters outside the Jena jail held was one that said fighting fascism is a Jewish value. Mahmoud Khalil was detained in March by federal immigration agents who illegally entered his private Columbia-owned apartment building here in New York City without a warrant. For more, we're joined by Ramzi Kassem, who's part of the legal team representing Mahmoud, professor of law at City University of New York, CUNY, where he founded and co-directs CLEAR, a legal clinic. The acronym stands for Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility. Ramzi, welcome back to Democracy Now! It was an emotional day yesterday in Jena, Louisiana. Can you describe what happened? First at 7 to 8 in the morning, and then describe the immigration hearing that Mahmoud testified at personally.
Thank you for having me again, Amy. As your segment noted, Mahmoud and Dr. Abdullah and baby Dean had their first opportunity since Dean's birth to be all together in one place. And it's really unfortunate that this administration forced us to go and get a federal court order to make that most basic human moment possible. You have to recall that Mr. Khalil is in immigration detention. That's supposed to be civil detention. It's supposed to be non-punitive. And I don't say this as a defense of what happens in criminal detention. But setting that aside, in a civil detention, non-punitive setting, the fact that the government was insisting on a no-contact visit was nothing short of cruel. And it's really unfortunate that we had to go get a court order for this legal meeting to happen in a way where Dr. Abdullah could discuss and meet with Mr. Khalil and with their baby in a way where they could hold each other for the first time since Mahmoud's unconstitutional detention. So that's how the day began. Then the immigration hearing proceeded. I want to highlight something that Mahmoud said, because it's really centrally important to how we look at all of this. Mahmoud, near the beginning of the hearing, said that he did not expect any due process from these immigration proceedings, and that's for a very simple reason. That is not a real court. The judge, the immigration judge, is a DOJ, Department of Justice functionary who serves at the pleasure of the president, who is subject to government pressures, who can be fired at any time by the president, unlike an independent federal court judge. And what we've seen in the immigration court proceedings confirms Mahmoud's instinct and his statements, because we've seen a rush to judgment that I've never seen before in over 20 years of practice in immigration court. And it's essentially an attempt to accelerate that case in a court that the government controls in front of a judge that answers to the president in order to railroad Mahmoud Khalil and find him deportable. Testimony was taken. The judge denied our motion for additional time to respond to the government's evidence. The judge denied our motion to terminate, to dismiss the immigration court proceedings because of Mahmoud's unlawful arrest. We now have an admission from the government that there was no warrant for the arrest. And we also have video confirming that the government lied when it said that Mahmoud tried to run away, which is why they arrested him. And so we sought to terminate the case. The judge denied that. And we expect now, after filing written closings on June 2nd, the immigration judge indicated that she was going to rule both on his removability and on his claims for relief, including asylum.
What do you know about Judge Jamie Comins?
Not much. I haven't practiced in Louisiana personally, but what I can tell you about this immigration judge, again, is true for all immigration judges. They serve at the pleasure of the president, and this is a president who has not been shy about firing immigration judges, both at the trial level and at the Board of Immigration Appeals.
I want to ask you, we just had Mohsen Mahdawi in the studio in New York, and the reason I'm emphasizing this is because he was freed from the Vermont prison where he was held, also a Columbia student, a friend of Mahmoud's. He was freed by a Vermont judge. And when the federal government threatened to arrest him if he went over state lines to attend his graduation, The judge was extremely forceful in saying that he can not only come to New York, attend graduation, he can participate in protests, he can talk to media, he can talk to government officials, etc. So he got his diploma in person. Then there's the Fulbright scholar, the Tufts grad student, Ramesa Ozturk. She also has gotten out of detention. She was flown down to Louisiana, but a judge ordered her freedom. What is stopping a judge releasing the federal judges in New Jersey, Farbiars, having Mahmoud released? He already lost the opportunity to be with his wife, a dentist, Noor Abdullah, when she gave birth to their son. Now he just had this one-hour visit. What is stopping them from allowing him to come back here while he goes through these proceedings?
Well, Amy, myself and my organization, CLEAR, we also represent, as you know, Ms. Ozturk and Mr. Mahdawi. And we're very grateful for the orders that you've mentioned by Judge Sessions in Ms. Ozturk's case and Judge Crawford in Mr. Mahdawi's case out of the district court in Vermont. And we respect their process and their decisions just as much as we respect Judge Farbiars's process in Mr. Khalil's case in federal court in New Jersey. The federal court in New Jersey has been actively engaged in Mr. Khalil's case. It has issued a number of rulings, all, by the way, going in favor of Mr. Khalil and against the government's arguments about venue and jurisdiction and the like. We have a number of motions pending before the federal court in New Jersey, a motion to release Mr. Khalil on bail, a motion to compel the government to bring him back from Louisiana to New Jersey, and of course, a preliminary injunction that would, set aside his detention. The judge is going through his process. We respect that process. We look forward to rulings on those motions, and we stand ready to provide the court with any additional information it might need or to argue any of these motions, as we were ready weeks ago to do. Every judge has their process. It's not for me to say what Judge Farbiars's process is, but he has been actively engaged, and we're looking forward to his rulings, because, again, we have no reason to expect and every reason not to expect due process out of the immigration courts.
What did Langston Hughes say? Justice delayed is justice denied, when you think of the landmarks in life that Mahmoud has already missed, like the birth of his son. But I wanted to ask you one more question, Ramsey. The Trump administration Thursday barred Harvard University from enrolling all international students by revoking its student exchange and visitor program certification. The news sent shockwaves way beyond Harvard, with legal experts warning the move is likely illegal. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem sent the email, cited anti-Semitism for the move, an accusation the Trump administration's also wielded against other universities when withdrawing federal funds. She also accused Harvard of, quote, coordinating with the Chinese Communist Party. In April, Harvard refused to abide by Trump's list of demands related to DEI and free speech. Harvard also challenged a Trump order, a Trump administration order, to hand over the records of its current international students. Over a quarter of Harvard's student body is international. Unless the courts block the Trump administration move, even current students at Harvard will have to transfer out of the university or lose their visas. The significance of this?
Well, you know, this is part of the Trump administration's ongoing flirtation with authoritarianism. Part of the authoritarian playbook is to go after the institutions in a society that are most likely to be centers of opposition to authoritarian policies and practices. Universities are among those. We've seen the attack on the legal sector, on the nonprofit sector, on activists, outspoken activists like Mr. Khalil. And so as far as universities go, stripping Harvard of its certification to enroll foreign students now and in the future takes away a big part of its income. A quarter of its students are foreign students. They tend to pay a larger share of tuition than U.S. Students. And of course, you know, taking away federal funding from universities like Harvard and Columbia is another dimension of this effort to undermine universities as potential sites of resistance. But the thing I'd like to highlight is that had universities and the Biden administration taken a different tack over the last 2 years, the political space for these radical measures by the Trump administration would not have been opened up. In other words, It is precisely because a number of universities, including Harvard and Columbia and others, and precisely because the Biden administration spent so much time calling their own students terrorists because they were speaking up in defense of Palestinian lives and rights and against the genocide, criminalizing them. That's what opened up the space for the Trump administration to then come in and abduct Mahmoud Khalil and take these radical measures to undercut universities like Harvard and Columbia.
Ramsey, we just got this breaking news that Harvard University has sued the Trump administration over the move to bar all international students from attending Harvard. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Ramsey Kassam, part of the legal team representing Mahmoud Khalil. He's a professor of law at City University of New York, CUNY. To see our interviews with Mohsen Mahdawi here in studio, and then just after he walked across the Columbia stage to receive his degree, go to democracynow.org. When we come back, this Sunday marks 5 years since police murdered George Floyd. Stay with us.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Living is easy with eyes closed. Misunderstanding always but it all works out. It doesn't matter much to me. Déjame llevarte hacia donde voy. Strawberry Fields.
Strawberry Fields Forever by La Santa Cecilia, performing here in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This Sunday marks 5 years since George Floyd, an African-American man, was murdered by former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who was white. In a video that shocked the world, spurred a global movement for racial justice, Chauvin pinned George Floyd to the ground with a knee on his neck for 8 minutes while George Floyd gasped for air. In a video that's now been seen around the world, he repeatedly said, "I can't breathe." The warning, the video is extremely graphic.
In your knee and his neck.
Yeah, oh, he got your
feet.
I cannot breathe.
You're just a grown, you're a tough guy. You're a tough guy. He's not even resisting arrest, bro.
His whole nose.
You don't have to fight with him.
Why you just sitting there? He ain't doing nothing now. Put him in the car.
It'll kill me.
Three other officers stood with Derek Chauvin, one of them holding back those who wanted to help George Floyd. In the days that followed, thousands took to the streets of Minneapolis and demonstrators set fire to a police precinct just hours after prosecutors said they were not yet sure if they would criminally charge Chauvin for murdering George Floyd, as seen in the video. Even as police fired tear gas and rubber-coated bullets at demonstrators, the protests spread to become the largest nationwide uprising since the 60s as protesters shut down cities across the United States.
George Floyd!
Despite the uprising that followed George Floyd's killing, Congress failed to pass the legislation named in Floyd's memory that sought to reduce racial profiling and the use of force by law enforcement. This comes as the Justice Department this week dismissed police reform and oversight agreements in Minneapolis and Louisville, or just days ahead of the 5th anniversary of the police murder of George Floyd. The consent decrees came in response to Floyd's murder, as well as the Louisville police killing of Breonna Taylor, March 13, 2020, after federal investigations found patterns of unconstitutional and racist police practicing in both cities. The Trump administration disputed those findings and dismissed the consent decrees as federal micromanagement. For more, we're joined in Minneapolis by Nakima Levy Armstrong, civil rights attorney, activist, founder of the Racial Justice Network, previously served as president of the Minneapolis NAACP. Nakima, welcome back to Democracy Now! We first spoke to you in 2020, 2 days after George Floyd's murder. Can you talk about the significance of this moment and what we can learn from what happened at the time? First, the charges not being brought, then it being taken out of the hands of the local authorities, and the state of Minnesota brought those charges.
Thank you for having me, Amy. We can learn from that moment that people in our community are not going to sit on the sidelines when folks in elected positions take their time in bringing about justice. As you know, there was an uprising that occurred in the city of Minneapolis as people applied pressure to elected officials to do their jobs and to ensure accountability, not only for Derek Chauvin, but the other three officers as well who were involved in the brutal killing of George Floyd.
Explain what the protests did. You know, we talked about the local authorities saying they weren't sure if they were going to bring charges. And then you had Keith Ellison, the attorney general of the state of Minnesota, who had formerly been a Congress member, and the governor. Talk about how the responsibility then shifted and the charges were brought and what happened to these four police officers.
Thank you for that question. I will say that it's important for people to understand that even when there is a video of heinous police abuse, that does not guarantee that justice will occur, as we just saw with Tyre Nichols and the way in which that particular case has panned out. So in the city of Minneapolis, one of the first steps was ensuring that all four officers were fired for their misconduct. And that was the result of Chief Madeira Arredondo, our city's first Black chief of police, making that decision within hours after George Floyd's murder came to light and meeting with Black community leaders to hear our perspectives before making that decision. Once that happened, of course, we had the first protest plan where thousands of people showed up at the site where George Floyd was killed. We marched to the 3rd Precinct police station where the officers had typically worked who were responsible for killing George Floyd. And then from that point, we started a rallying cry for those officers to be charged and arrested for what they did. Now, the governmental officials were slow to respond initially. And after some public pressure, the county attorney at the time, Mike Freeman, decided to only charge Derek Chauvin. The charges were legally insufficient. They were below the standard, as well as the criminal complaint against Derek Chauvin. So when I saw that, I reached out to movement lawyers through the National Lawyers Guild. I expressed my concerns about the process. They agreed with me. So we called a mass demonstration along with other activist organizations like Black Lives Matter. And we had thousands of people in front of the governor's mansion explaining to people how the charging decision by the county attorney was inadequate. And Governor Walz actually came out of his mansion. He listened to us break down what the concerns were, how things needed to change. And after that, I received a call from his staff to meet with him directly. So he and I had a Zoom call. During that call, I laid out more of the legal issues, as well as the fact that he needed to use his executive authority to remove the case from the hands of the county attorney and to put the case into the hands of the attorney general. And Amy, you and the rest of the world saw the results of that trial during the prosecution of Derek Chauvin, which was a masterclass on how to effectively and successfully prosecute a cop who used deadly force unjustifiably. once the case was in the hands of the Attorney General's office, the other thing that happened is that not only was Derek Chauvin charged, but all four of the officers were charged as well. And the charges for Derek Chauvin were also upgraded. And as you know, ultimately, all four of those officers were convicted in state and federal court as a result of the murder of George Floyd.
In 30 seconds, can you tell us about Trump lifting the consent decrees off of the Minneapolis Police Department, Louisville, Breonna Taylor, the significance of this?
It is very clear that Donald Trump's intention is to roll back the progress that began, I would say, in 2020 and even before that, when the folks in Ferguson, Missouri, rose up after Mike Brown was killed. It is a slap in the face to the Black community and communities around the country for Trump's DOJ to withdraw from the consent decree process. It's unconscionable. It's unacceptable. And I would argue that it is an attempt to create a race war, wanting us to take to the streets so that Donald Trump can use martial law against protesters. But we're not falling for the bait. We are continuing to call out these injustices and to say that we are expecting accountability. We're expecting reform and transformation of police departments that engage in unconstitutional policing practices.
Nikki, we just have another 30 seconds. And my question to you is, the police murder of George Floyd happened during the first term of President Trump. To say the least, he's been openly hostile to the Black Lives Movement. In 2020, he reportedly ordered the military to, quote, beat the F out of BLM protesters, even shoot them. Where does the movement go from here as you market in Minneapolis this weekend?
I think that the movement has to continue to grow stronger. We have to resist the pressure that is coming from the White House to be silent and to feel as if the concerns that we're bringing don't hold merit. We know that is not the truth. We know that racial injustice in America is still alive and well. We know that police brutality continues to occur at alarming rates. And we have to continue to use our voices and stand up against Donald Trump and stand up against these systems of oppression, regardless of the pressure that he is attempting to apply in this hour. This moment calls for us to rise up and continue to take a stand for freedom, justice, and equality in this country, and especially for those who are most vulnerable to police violence and oppression.
Nikema Levy-Armstrong, I want to thank you so much for being with us from Minneapolis, civil rights attorney, activist, founder of the Racial Justice Network. As we mark the fifth anniversary of the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, what the New York Times called one of America's most liberal cities, we end today's show with a new book that reexamines the experience of the civil rights leader, Dr. Martin Luther King, with police brutality and his sustained critique of police brutality in the North as well as the South. Jean Theo Harris is a historian and professor of political science at Brooklyn College, author of 13 books about the civil rights movement, the fight for racial justice. Her new book is King of the North, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life of Struggle Outside the South. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you start off with another viral moment, an image of police brutality that you describe in your book? I watched you talk about it last night at the Brooklyn Public Library. The photo of Reverend Martin Luther King being arrested in 1958.
So, Dr. King, thank you for having me back. It's so great to be here. So this is 1958. Dr. King and Curtis Scott King have gone to see Ralph Abernathy in court. The court doesn't want him there. The police then start to harass him at the courthouse and then decide they're going to arrest him. They push her away. She's objecting. And they basically march him down the street. But there happens to be a photographer. And so as they're marching him down the street and into the police station, this photographer's taking pictures. And what they do when they get to the police station is they half Nelson him, as we see in this photo, onto the counter. They're like grabbing his arm and twisting it. You can tell he's in pain. And then once they get out of sight, because as you might imagine, they're mad. The police are mad that Dr. King, that somebody's been taking this picture. So once they get him in the cell, they kick him, they choke him, they try to break his arm. But this photo goes in the terms of 1958. It goes out over the news wires. And it may be the first, it's certainly one of the first images of police brutality that make it into the mainstream news. Most mainstream news organizations did not cover police brutality. So this image is outrageous and it's outraging. And 2 weeks later, he comes to Harlem and he's doing a nighttime rally on 125th Street, right down from Malcolm X's speaker corner, right down from where Johnson Hinton had been brutalized by police. And Dr. King talks about
this is what year?
This is 2 weeks after. Uh-huh. This is 1958. And he's there with thousands of New Yorkers, and he's talking about his own experience with police brutality, and Harlemites are angry, and they see themselves in him. And I think we often miss this as a key issue throughout the civil rights movement. We often put it in the South when Dr. King and many others are calling attention and protesting this across the country.
He said he was more scared in Chicago than he'd ever been in the South. But you talk about in 1964 in Harlem also, right. King decrying the police killing of an unarmed teenager, yep. was sued by the New York's police officer who killed the young man. And there was a march there that actually dwarfed the March on Washington in 63.
Right. There's huge marches that what you're referring to is he calls for this officer, Thomas Gilligan. He calls the what he does a murder, just like you were just doing about George Floyd, the police murder.
Oh, and he was convicted.
And the cop sues him for damage to his reputation. And one of the, you know, and all the newspapers then let the cop launder his reputation. So King comes to New York. Mayor Wagner invites King, thinking King is going to maybe help quiet down these protests. They're massive protests for days. And instead, King, in a series of meetings with the mayor, says you need to fire the cop. You need to have real civilian like complaint review board. You need to have a jobs program. You need to desegregate. Mayor Wagner rejects it all. And basically, King is like almost run out of town for the notion that he's calling for a kind of real civilian oversight of the police. And this is 1964 here, right here in New York City.
Professor Theo Harris, we just have a minute, and we're going to do a post show and post it at democracynow.org to talk about the revelations in this book. How could we be talking about revelations about Dr. King because he's been written about so thoroughly, yet it's this radical history, especially around police killings of black men and women, that you say has really not been thoroughly documented.
I mean, I think we've Southernized Dr. King. And so his critique of police brutality outside the South, his longstanding critique of school segregation, of housing segregation, of job discrimination. King sees these as national, not local. But again, we've told a story where King is in the South till 1965, and somehow then when Watts erupts, then he discovers the North. When, in fact, Dr. King had been in L.A. more than 15 times before the Watts uprising, had been protesting around police brutality for years, joined a movement in 1962 protesting the police killing of Nation of Islam Secretary Ron Stokes, had talked about, this is King, no compromise on this issue in L.A. in 1962. In 1963, calling L.A. as segregated as Birmingham, even while he's engaged in the movement in Birmingham. But we tend to see that as a Southern story when King is talking about everywhere.
And that's why you titled the book King of the North. We're going to talk more about it at democracynow.org. Jean Theo Harris, historian, new book, King of the North, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Life of Struggle Outside the South. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Mike DeFilippo. Coming up Memorial Day, our special, we speak to acclaimed filmmaker Ryan Coogler about his new film, Sinners, and to Keith Lamar on death row in Ohio. Look for our new job listings. We're hiring a senior headline news producer, director of audience, director of technology. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m., tune in to Department Uno to hear the latest and greatest from the CJSF playlist. featuring all new music from local, Canadian, and international artists. Fresh releases from the music department every week on Department Uno, only on CJSF 90.1 FM.